So turning, I now caused my heart to despair, for I worked hard under the sun just for air. A man who works wisely with knowledge and skill leaves all to a man who works not for it still. And vanity also is this which is shown, so clearly to me a great evil is known. Proverbs or Ecclesiastes, actually. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 20 and 21. It's a lot like the book of Ecclesiastes is a lot like the book of Proverbs. Both are written or at least edited by King Solomon. Whether he originated all of them, I don't know that we can say that for certain, but it's Solomon's writing here, the Ecclesiastes of Solomon, and many of the Proverbs are by Solomon, not all of them, not at all. But anyway, Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 20 and 21, in the Word Green version from 2020, is our daily scripture for today, little children. It's been so, not stressful, but just busy. I've been receiving things. I've done so many things that I want to talk about, but really I'm in the middle of some things I can't talk about. Well, let's start with the belt. Let's start with the belt, because that way I won't forget. And also, maybe I can remember to resize this window. Is it? Well, that's not even it. Here it is. Okay. There are two windows that are there, actually, and one of them was an unidentified window. This is my belt now with the belt loop on it. See, I got this only in this day and age, for the first time ever in history, it's possible to order an item, get it the next day, and finish the project that you are working on. And it's all because of Amazon. Amazon has been the pioneer, and the new age is arriving because of both Amazon and also China, because a lot of these things are made in China. We couldn't do it without China. But look at this belt loop. I mean, there it is. I stapled it with two staples behind at the back, which are, they're not visible. They're underneath here, the two staples that hold this belt loop together. And anyway, it looks a lot better now with the belt loop, because it's going to be held in place without being so uncontrollable, or, you know, it might even come undone, of course, if I didn't have the belt loop. So, go back to the sizing we had. I wonder what this other size is. Can I delete it? Delete that. I don't even know if we're allowed to. There's another window. Anyway, we just won't bother with it right now. We are on chapter 2, paragraph 4 of our article. And I have not prepared today because I've been so busy. I've been working on a lot of things, some of which I can't talk about because I'm still in the middle of them. The belt I finished, so I could still stain it more. But the process of staining it, where I soaked it in water, made it too stiff, and it stiffened the leather in a way I didn't like. So I don't really think I'll be staining it more unless it's just by rubbing some stain on it, on the surface of it. But it's not. It lightened up, I think, overnight even, because it dried out. Once the water dried out, it wasn't nearly as stained as I thought. So, but, you know, I learned a lot about using stain, you know, in a very short time. I learned some very important things about how to stain leather yesterday. We have this beautiful piece of artwork here, which is actually from a church in Vietnam, a temple in Vietnam. And it shows the eight immortals. And even though, you know, it's greatly different from Noah and his wife and his three sons and their wives, it's not four men and four women, for example. So it doesn't even have that the same. It's greatly confused, right? But it's the same story of eight people surviving a deluge. The eight immortals. Remarkable. It's the same story that you get when you look at China and the Monkey King movies, where Nimrod is the Monkey King, I believe. He's representing the monkey. The Monkey King is representing Nimrod. And I think, he's a very interesting character in the Monkey King movies. And the priest represents Shem, supposedly, or somebody, or Heber, or somebody who is a priest from the Far East, but he's at a time so far back in history that it's at the time of Nimrod and the Tower of Babel and things like that. But all the mythological things that occur in these movies, of course, they're not necessarily things that correspond to real events, but they contain hints and clues about the ancient time periods, the ancient history, such as the eight immortals representing the eight survivors of the deluge. And so Noah and his three sons are represented and paralleled by the Chinese mythology in these eight immortals. And they wear rainbow-colored clothing. Of course, the rainbow was something in the Bible that was given after the deluge as a sign. It was the sign that God would no more bring the earth to ruin by means of a deluge. That was the sign that God gave. And there are so many different corrupt versions of what people say about the Bible, that it's ridiculous. Some people say that, I don't even want to start. I guess I don't want to mock other people. I don't want to start saying, but if the rainbow had never occurred before, then it would have more meaning, right? Because it had never rained before. So that idea, and in the Bible it says that the water had gone up to water the ground, the mist came up to water the ground in the days of the Garden of Eden. It didn't say it was watered by rain from heaven in the days of the Garden of Eden, but there are people who seem to think that, well, that's a different reality from what they're claiming, and they would try to make everything back in the ancient times just the same as it is today. They want everything to be the same in ancient times as it was today, but that's not necessarily true. And this could have been the very first rainbow ever after the deluge. That's possible, right? It makes it have a lot more meaning if it does. If it was the first rainbow. Now, the word for rainbow is ni in Chinese. It's formed from the ancient kanji, MBHXU, or one moon bamboo disaster mountain. That's what all those things are, all these symbols represent. And they're all combined into this one Chinese kanji symbol. See, Chinese is a symbolic language, so it uses symbols. And all these symbols, the one moon, the one is the horizontal line. The moon is this second character from the left. Now, Chinese might be read in a different direction from left to right, but here we have it, left to right, we're reading this. And then we've got the bamboo is this third character from the left. And we've got, so that's, we have the one, the moon, and the bamboo. And then, disaster is this symbol. And then the mountain, this symbol, three prongs. So it's interesting that it was one moon, bamboo, disaster, mountain that represented the rainbow. Because there was a disaster and there was a mountain involved, and you know, how the moon was involved would have to be thought about, and we'd have to ponder that to come up with some more explanation about that. But Cootie Daggy, Chesnacky Dag, the mountain where Noah's Ark descended, is also known as Doomsday Mountain. That's fascinating. Because, of course, that was Doomsday when the deluge came. After the biblical global deluge, Jehovah gave a sign of a covenant between him and mankind that no more would waters become a deluge to bring all flesh to ruin. The sign was a rainbow. So how would that sign have meaning if they'd seen rainbows many times before? How would it mean anything to them? I mean, it seems like it would certainly have had more meaning had it been a very new phenomenon that they had never seen. He said in the future it would accompany clouds in Genesis 9:11-17. To quote, "It shall occur that when I bring a cloud over the earth, the rainbow will come to be in the cloud." So that certainly sounds like there had not been any rainbows prior to this time. And now there would be, from this time forward, rainbows. A tombstone found in the area of the Ark site had carvings of a boat. On a large wave, a rainbow. That's right, on the tombstone there was a rainbow. This was right in the area of the Ark site. It was at the place where they thought Noah's house was, and where it was on the tombstone, the carving of the rainbow was. And that was the tombstone that was, they thought it was, I think that was the one that was for Noah's wife, I believe, is the one that had the rainbow. But it's hard, I mean, there are a lot of things to study, a lot of interesting things to look at in the videos that we looked at yesterday, for example, and all those videos from these people who are concerned with studying Noah's Ark and the discovery of Noah's Ark and all of that. All of these videos that are out there by the people who knew Ron Wyatt in particular, those are the people to whom I'm referring, who knew about this rainbow phenomenon, this thing that was on the inscribed on the tombstone. And so, you know, we can get into all of that, but we might not get into it in these videos, but people can study all that on their own. I'm interested in studying it more, certainly, so I intend to study it more, and I will. I don't doubt that, but the question is when. And people in number equal to the number of Noah, his wife, his three sons, and the three wives of his sons. All of those things were on the same tombstone. There was a boat with a large wave, a rainbow, and the number of people, 8 of the survivors of the deluge. All of those things were carved on that tombstone. So that almost, and it showed Noah's wife with her eyes looking downward, I think, on that one. That's why it was thought to be, there it is, Noah's Ark video. It's at the 34-minute mark, and 40 to 52 seconds. We should go there. Where's the Noah's Ark video? Which one's that? This one? Yeah, it's this one. Okay, so let's, do we have it open already? We might. What is it? This is it, Noah's Ark. Let's see if we can get to mute that. Is there even a 34-minute mark? Are we even on YouTube here? Yeah, we are. But I can't jump. It's not letting me. It's maximize it. Oh, I know why, because it's because there's an ad playing right now. There we go. So let's go to, is there a 34 minute mark right here? Let's see. 34, right there. 34. What is that?
I think there's an eighth one up there.
No, that's... Oh, yeah, that was interesting. 34 minutes, Noah's house.
Our next taxi stop is the home of Noah, near the village of Kazan. This photo was taken in 1977 by Ron Wyatt, showing the walls of Noah's home. Since then, all the walls have been torn down by local treasure seekers. In the front yard stood this large tombstone. On the tombstone was a drawing of eight people and a boat on a wave. The second largest person was looking downward with their eyes closed. This indicates that this was Mrs. Noah's tombstone. After Mr. Wyatt showed this to someone, that person later hired others to exhume Mrs. Noah's 18-foot sarcophagus. Its depression in the ground is still...
That's a real tragedy. What happened? See, people would come and they'd steal the treasures, like, from the tombs or from... it. Even if there weren't any treasures, they would destroy the whole house trying to tear it apart and find treasures. That's what happened. But this is incredible. So that is the story. I even documented it so we could find it just now, which I didn't know that would be possible. Today, I didn't realize that, but that's the end of our study for today of that of this article. And we saw in the video there that there was the tombstone, evidently the tombstone of the wife of Noah, whose name we don't actually know, although her name is preserved in certain traditions, which I, at the moment, don't recall. But it's not in the Bible. It's not in the Bible, so it's not like it's something that is an inspired message that we have to, you know, that we're an inspired knowledge, a piece of knowledge that we have to, you know, accept, whatever it was. I would like to know her name. I just can't remember what her name was right now. I have to research my own site, I think, to find it. Let's go back again. Oh, there's the other. Look, here's the other. This is Ron's two sons talking about how their cars stopped over and over and over. And there's the Ark in the background behind them, in between. There's the Ark relic there in the mudslide on the mountain. And they told the story of how their car broke down. Ron, their father, his car was what they were traveling in, and that car was breaking down. And that helped them find the Ark itself and all these sites around where the anchor stones were and where Noah's house was, I believe. They found these things because their car broke down in these places, and they didn't find these places till later, but because they marked the places where the car broke down, they were able to go back later and find, by exploring from the point where their car had broken down, all these different things that they found. They found them that way. So let's continue our Thor Heyerdahl video now. We're on... I'm not going to believe it. I don't believe it's wise to trust my memory on this. I'm just going to check. We've done part four. Yeah. So we're up to 20 minutes now, so we're looking for... And we'll try to mute this if we have to prevent any ads from coming in. We're up to about 20 minutes here. Right about here. Let's see how this goes. Let's resize. Where am I? There we are. Okay. I'm ready.
The bow is finished off in an elegant tip. But not so the stern. That is chopped off straight, just like the coastwise boats of ancient Nineveh. For this craft will never be launched on the high seas, only on Lake Chad. Heyerdahl finds the reed boats of Lake Chad fantastically buoyant and steady. It is his first time in a papyrus boat, and he begins to believe the papyrus might well be capable of carrying men across the sea.
Here I could find all the papyrus I needed, and boat builders who could build a papyrus boat as large as I wanted. But there was neither railway, road, nor river leading to the sea, so I could not get all the papyrus I needed out of the country. The boat builders, though, I could arrange the long journey for. I explained to the interpreter, Abdullah, that he should ask Omar if he would build me a boat in Egypt together with his brother Musa. Including Abdullah, whom I needed as interpreter, I required 3 men. But where, then, was I now to obtain the papyrus? I went to the sources of the Nile in Ethiopia.
At Tissasat Falls, the world of the Nile divides into 2 levels. Above the falls on the Ethiopian high plateau, papyrus still grows, and up there, at the sources of the Nile, the papyrus boat is still in use. Both double-ended and cut-off boats are still used by the Laki tribes and the Coptic monks who live on the islands. Led by the Coptic monks, Heyerdahl sets off to choose the best place for getting all the papyrus he needs. He arranges to have it cut, dried, and transported across the mountains to the Red Sea coast. 12 tons of dry and inflammable papyrus reeds are shipped from the shores of Lake Tana through the troubled war zone at the Suez to Cairo in the Nile Valley. The papyrus reed is a soft flower stem, spongy on the inside. A child can crush it in his hand. Dry, it snaps like a matchstick and burns like paper. But wet, with its thin, watertight skin, it becomes flexible and extraordinarily tough. Only the cut ends will absorb water.
Abdullah, Omar, and Musa seemed most pleased with the material. But when I showed them the building site, they asked me where the lake was in which to soak all the papyrus. It had first to be dried in the sun so as not to rot, but then it had to be soaked so as not to break. I had to start hauling water out into the desert in drums. Björn Landström, the leading expert on prehistoric Egyptian boat types, got to see real papyrus for the first time and how light it was in the water.
The papyrus has to be soaked, so a water tank is improvised.
So, just to explain, they were putting the papyrus into a barrel of water, and when they released it from their hand, even though the barrel was only about three or four feet tall, and the papyrus was maybe 7 or 8 feet tall, when they released the papyrus, having pushed it to the bottom of the barrel, it shot straight up in the air and went out of the barrel, flew out of the barrel, because of the buoyancy of the papyrus being so high, very buoyant.
It floats so well, it costs 3 men great difficulty and time just to submerge a single bundle, and Heyerdahl has shipped in 500 bundles. On the basis of many years' study in museums and burial chambers, Bjorn Landström draws the plans for the boat. Like all the other experts, he is certain from the start that a papyrus boat will sink after a couple of weeks. Nevertheless, Landstrom is keen to see the boat built, if only to test its sailing qualities.
That's it then. We're done for today on the Thor Heyerdahl Raw Expeditions movie, which I'm fairly certain I did see many years ago. But maybe it was not in the same exact form that it's in now. I'm not sure about that. Whether this is a different, movie format than the format we saw on television years and years ago. It seems to me we watched many episodes of this. But I may be incorrect. I mean, my memory might not be accurate on that. It just stays with me that we did watch those wonderful expeditions of Thor Heyerdahl and his men. Thor Heyerdahl, the Raw Expeditions, or the Ray Expeditions, as we could possibly also pronounce it. Here we also have a picture at the beginning of our next chapter of Kang Ji, who we identified with as the emperor also, by the name of Fu Shi. He was the second prior emperor to the Yellow Emperor. So he's essentially the grandfather of the Yellow Emperor, if we accept the genealogy and the identifications from the Bible. So this is showing Kang Ji as having this very interesting double set of eyes. And only in Chinese mythology, do you get such remarkable, curious, phenomena. Things that you could never have really thought up or dreamed up, it seems like. And I find that to be true, speaking for myself, of the Monkey King movies, too, that there are things in those movies that I would never have thought were possible for a human being to dream up. And so maybe they are true according to the history. They're bringing us elements of history that were actually real, that did have some correspondence, to the events that happened in that time, in the 2700s BCE, the time of the Tower of Babel and the battle that it ensued, and then the scattering, the scattering of the people, the confusion, the dividing of the land. But there was a battle, according to the Book of Jubilees, the battle was in the Chinese mythology, sorry. So there may not have been a battle, but in the Chinese mythology, there was a battle between Nimrod and Shinnong. And also the land of Shinar has the same name almost as the name China. Shinar and China, it's the same word. It's where would Shinar have come from if it didn't correspond? How could it not correspond to China? But, I mean, where would China have come from, I mean, if it didn't come from Shinar? So, it's really a wonderful exploration and a voyage or a journey of discovery to study all these things. When they traveled on land, of course, it was a different story from the traveling of the eight immortals over the water here during the deluge, which we consider to be, the time of Noah and his family and their survival. But, I mean, after the deluge, there must have been travel by water and land, both by water and by land. But when the group of survivors, whoever they were, all of them, came to the plains of Shinar, and there's not much mentioned in the Bible about that. It was several hundred years after the deluge, right? It was 500 years after the deluge when these things happened. But it would have required 500 years for the population to multiply, and you know, for at that time the patriarchs didn't have children until they were a lot older than we today, when we have children, for example. So according to the Bible, all these things make sense, that it would have taken 500 years for them to grow in numbers sufficiently for them to do all those things, and you know, grow to go down, travel down to the land of Shinar and do that. Now, Nimrod was a son of Cush, who was a son of Ham. He was from the son Ham, not from Shem. Nimrod was from a different son of Noah. And then, I don't know if I can do this. They journeyed eastward, it says. They eventually discovered a valley plain in the land of Shinar. But it's really south of the ark site, of course. They somehow journeyed and arrived at Shinar. And that we are fairly sure we know where Shinar is, because it's at the place where later on it was called Babylon. But it was also the place where the ruins of the Tower of Babel are found. So there's a place where the ancient Tower of Babel was evidently built, and it's at this place, which is called Babylon in later years. It's in Iran, or is it Iraq? Someplace near, I think it's in Iraq, actually, the Tower of Babel, isn't it? But I'm not sure, yeah. I think so. But brick served as stone for them. But they wanted to build a tower. And that's all it really says. It doesn't say how far they traveled or where they were traveling from, you know, exactly where. It doesn't give us all the details of, you know, exactly when this happened or anything. But we worked out the details of the dates from the study that we did, so and that's what I've been presenting in the genealogy, the chronology that tells us this was in the 2700s BCE when this happened, 2773, and after that, in that time period. That's it for today. It's September 18th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1953 hours, North American Eastern Standard Daylight Savings Time. Still daylight savings right now, Eastern Daylight Time in North America. This is Liv Dusty. This is Cassie saying bye for now on my behalf. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. That was the Ark of Urartu, Chapter 2, Paragraph 4 today that we studied.